Well, just let that bagpipe fade right out. That was Pete Samples with Standing Upon the Shoulders of Giants. Before that, Painted Palms and a track called Spinning Signs, and mightily like the Beach Boys, I'd say, which is maybe not a bad thing. Anyways, that's it for Breakfast with the Browns for this week, nearly 11. And yeah, enjoy. Apparently there's going to be sun the remainder of the week, and it's solstice, not equinox, and I should have known better, but what do they call these brain farts? I know, it's kind of rude, but it's what happens, and I think it's because I kept looking at John Hassel CD, which of course has equinox, solstice, not solstice, but equinox in the title. Okay, I'm making up excuses. Anyways, up next, and we just have to sort some things out, is a new show called Language to Language. But I'll leave you with our traditional goodbye track. And then we'll ease our way into this new program. And let's see. Just make sure I have this. Anyways, take care of yourselves.
Everybody happy? You can't come in. You can't come in.
This is the end. know this is the end. You're wondering now what to do. Now you know this is the end.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gaila Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaweitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
My name is Isabel Francis, and my husband was Louis Francis, who died in 1971. And he went to school in Spanish. My husband was up there till he was 16, and his sister was up there till she was 16. She left 2 years before he did, and he had a younger sister and a younger brother that also went to school up there. He spoke about the conditions up there maybe once or twice, but he never wanted to talk about it. Because there were a lot of unpleasant things that were happening to him. He always said, don't ever forget how lucky you are that you were raised by your parents. When he came back at 16, he couldn't talk to his father. His father couldn't speak English and he couldn't speak Mohawk. So there was no togetherness there.
I hear that the mission of residential schools was to, quote-unquote, kill the Indian in the child. So that's...
Well, I think they did a pretty good job of that, but to some extent. But I think nobody can do that. I mean, it can't be done, not to make them forget. Look at the First World War, the Second World War, what the Germans and the Japanese did. They couldn't wipe out the good in the people.
His experience up there, would you say it was all bad, or were there...
Well, no. He always said there were some good priests up there. I don't mean to condemn every one of them. Just like in any situation, there's always one that pops out that is against the rules. The only thing I can't forget is that how did the people that were in there get away with something like that? Mm-hmm. One apology doesn't wipe out everything. There are certain things that stand in their mind and that they'll never forget. But that's the way it is now.
Well, thank you, Grandma.
Oh, no problem.
I love you.
I love you too.
You have just heard at Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
together. There are many ways to endure. Pulling and pulling, pulling towards the future. All around the waters may be rough, with one beat we'll be there sure enough. We're pulling on the sailor's seas. 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 Together, together.
It's Monday.
Oh my God.
11:10 CITR time.
Well, welcome to Language to Language. Tulangeth Andi Angalam. I'm honored to be in your presence. And I think I'll just refer to listeners here as Ditaulung. Ditaulung in Haida means we're so closely related that we can joke with each other real hard and we can't get mad. So that means that we're not just strangers, even though we're on both and different ends of this microphone.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'll introduce myself in Haida. There are two of us here. Gunarji, you're probably very, very familiar with hearing her on other radio stations and also on this one. And in English, I'm just Woody Morris. And in Haida, Kaunsinga Iskan kitu kun iskan kauda hangas hinu di kya an. Zetlanas hat ai u di ijin. Gatsakas u di kualaten. Woodrow Morrison hinu di ya aaj hat ai kit kya an. Di au chayang hinu hat kit. Virginia Cloud hinu maidenim kai laga hidan. Wagyan di hung hansanan. Woodrow Morrison Sr. Kyagan is Gantla da Hatkith Kyagan. So, what I said is, in Haida I have three names. Kaunsinga is a one who brings a special day. It's a man walks in a room carrying a newborn child. And the other name, Kitu Kun, is the butt of the spear. This is the man who stands, sets the butt of the spear while the giant brown bear charges. It's a man who perseveres and holds his ground. Kauda hangas, literally translated as ugly sit down. But that's an eagle that knew how to let go when it got pulled underwater by a large salmon. then it flew in up on top of a tree to dry his feathers in the sun. So that's someone who knows when to let go, to fly high above and observe. And then Tzatlana's Hat Aoi the Ijim. Tzatlana is the name of my crest. It's an eagle with two heads. Actually, it's two eagles sitting on a branch facing in opposite directions. But Tzatl is a bird that flies from New Zealand across the Pacific and up into the Arctic. It nests as it young and flies all the way back to New Zealand. In English, it's called the Pacific Golden Plover. And at home, they used to refer to it as the Eskimo bird. And then when I say Gatsakas Diokwalagn, our population is called Kwala. That's all of us Haidas, Kwala. But we're divided into two parts, eagle and raven. Tzak is a word we got from the Dene people for the bald-headed eagle. It accompanied the Dene-speaking people when they returned from the south after the ice melted at the end of the last ice age. So we on the Alaska side, the Kishat I were called, we use the word tzak. And then our word for an immature eagle is oot. And that's the word the Masset people use in Skidigits, oot, kwalagn. Then, yaachat ai kitkyaang is our word, is what we call the English language. Yaachat ai. Yaach is iron, or yaach is a knife. So when the Spaniards came with that sword and they were sticking it in the ground, we thought they were doing some strange way of digging clams, but they were claiming the land for Spain. So we called them the people of that iron knife. And then my mother in Haida was called Chayang, her maiden name Virginia Cloud. My father, Woodrow Morrison Sr., is in English, and then in Haida, Tla Dai. He was chief of the Brown Bear House, and that's a big man. Well, for language to language, there is so much not known when we talk about our languages. Are they simply noises, noisy blasts of air forever gone? Are they simply vocabularies and grammar? Or is there much more to them? Well, that's what we'd like to explore with this program. Language to language, not just Haida, but many of the other indigenous languages, because our languages are so different that you really can't make very good translations across the different languages the way you can in Europe. There's a new professor coming here to University of British Columbia in July, Dr. Wade Davis. And I'd like to read something that he wrote in a foreword for a book called Hatkith, that, you know, the Haida language. That is what that which makes us Haida. And he said, language is not just a set of grammatical rules or vocabulary. It does not exist merely to permit communication. To the contrary, every language is a flash of the human spirit, the vehicle by which the soul of a particular culture comes into the material world. Every language is an old-growth forest of the mind, a watershed of thought, an ecosystem of society's spiritual and psychological possibilities. Each is a window into the universe, a monument to the specific culture that gave it birth and whose spirit it expresses. Well, some of that might be just a little bit obscure, or it sounds good, but what does it really mean? Well, a man named Robert Bringhurst wrote three books dealing with a blind storyteller by the name of Gundel. And in his book called A Story as Sharp as a Knife, what he says is that all classical Haida literature is oral. By definition, therefore, it is something printed books cannot contain in precisely the same sense that jazz or the classical music of India is music that a score cannot contain. Every healthy living culture holds its story to its heart, and so the book, in the fundamental yet intangible sense, is a cultural universal. This, however, is a book composed in homage to what script and permit omit, and to the intellectual richness of a world where no manuscripts or printed books exist. Reading, like speech, is an ancient preliterate craft. We read the tracks and scat of animals, the depth and luster of their coats, the set of their ears, the gait of their limbs. We read the horns of sheep, the teeth of horses. We read the weights and measures of the wind, the flight of birds, the surface of the sea, snow, fossils, broken rocks, the growth of shrubs and trees and lichens. We also read, of course, the voices that we hear. We read the speech of jays, ravens, hawks, frogs, wolves, and in infinite detail the voices, faces, gestures, coughs, and postures of other human beings. This is a serious kind of reading, and it antedates all but the earliest, most involuntary form of writing, which is the leaving of prints and traces, the making of tracks. The works of literature translated and discussed here were made in such a world, where the performance could be read but the work could not. Now they're frozen, verbatim transcripts of single performances. Voices hide in these transcripts. If they were to speak, we must find a way to listen. That is difficult to do so long as we keep thinking of the fixed and silent texts that have come to overshadow every other kind of literature in the European tradition. All literature is oral at its root, so the dilemma is unreal. Dante, Shakespeare, Melville, Flaubert, Joyce are read because they speak through the pedants' books are mum. Yet the oral poet's strategies and tactics differ from the writer's, and the tactics of the listener are different from the reader's. Once it is transcribed, oral literature looks like writing, but as every reader senses, that is not quite what it is. Native American oral literature in general, and Haida oral literature in particular, seem to be far closer in spirit and form to European painting and to European music than to European literature. This is one way out of the dilemma. Reading works of oral literature is more like reading musical scores and narrative paintings than it is like reading books. In my attempts to set the best Haida poets in a global context, I found Bach and Tinian and Velázquez more immediately helpful than Racine. So he goes on to describe how different the oral tradition is from the written. Once you write it down, it's written in stone and cannot change. You can't write in certain sounds, certain emotions. And that's somewhat today, I think we take a look and listen as to what's going on here with the dispute between the province and the teachers. The province is saying that we want to put more technology into the classroom. They want to replace teachers with technology. Yet if you go and take a look at the Incan Empire, they didn't have a written language. But look at the technology. Look at the things that they were able to do without a written language. All their professors were organic libraries. They carried their memories with them. They spoke from what knowledge they carried. And so when we begin reducing ourselves to writing, we're actually dumbing ourselves down. And we're getting to the point now where we can't even remember our own telephone number without having to look at the telephone. So when we look at these stories, we have to really stop and think, what are we doing to ourselves? Something else he wrote was the differences, my differences. Well, I'll read a little bit more. It says, to those concerned about such things, I think it'll be clear how much I owe to the work of several scholars. Del Himes and Claude Levi Strauss are among the first to come to mind. My differences from Himes, I think, like to think, are superficial. He used words, measured verse, to describe the structural patterns of thought and language he patiently unearthed, and Kathlamet, Kitschk, and many other oral literatures. Himes and I were completely in agreement about the reality, vitality, and importance of these patterns, and I wish I had the gift of discerning them. I also wish that he had given them a different name. Perversely, then, I've expressed my admiration for his work and for his skills as a polylingual critic by defining or avoiding his key terms. So, as we progress with our program here over the next year or so, or years, I would like to read some more of what Robert Bringhurst writes. Not only that, but also the translations he did in translating the stories of this blind oral poet, this Haida historian. So then there's one other book that we'll be looking at, is David Peet's Blackfoot Physics. And I'll read just a little bit about what he wrote about languages. Well, he said, language of a people is their life, but in many cases the life is endangered. Within several communities, the traditional language is spoken by only a handful of elders. In other cases, the last speakers of some languages passed away earlier this century. Well, that's the last century. And in a deep sense, this may be also the end of their societies. A people can no more live without its language than a tree can grow without roots. But how can a language be that important? Most of us take it for granted that anything we say in English can be equally well expressed in Spanish, French, or German. People who've attended business meetings in Europe and have experienced simultaneous translations are amazed at the speed with which their sentences can be switched from one language to another. If ideas can be translated so rapidly between English, German, Italian, and French, what can be so special about, say, Huron, Mohawk, Haida, Kitsan, Musqueam? But suppose instead of dealing with European languages, you were to go into a law court with a Native American witness. Your experience would be quite different. Natives love to joke about those situations in which a judge makes a brief remark and waits while the translation begins a long oration in an indigenous language. The judge asked in surprise, "Did I really say that?" The translator replies, "Yes, more or less." But the judge will say, "I only spoke a couple of sentences and you went on for about 20 minutes. A little later, when asked a question, the native witness will begin a long speech, at the end of which the translator may simply report, "The witness says no." So, what is going on is not simply a matter of moving between two different languages, but of translating between profoundly different worldviews. What to the judge was a single sentence may have contained words that are related to concepts that touch on issues that are never found within a traditional indigenous worldview. The translator will have to set the scene, as it were, and provide the context in which the judge's brief remarks can be understood. Likewise, the saying no within some cultures may depend upon a variety of factors that are not thought to be relevant in ours. These issues do not arise when we translate between English, Spanish, French, and German, because Europeans and North Americans share a common worldview. Our notions of reality, time, space, and causality are more or less identical. So there's no need for a translator to deal with radically different concepts when discussing a land deal. A similar case of movement between English and Mohawk, Cree, Hopi, or Haida is not possible. Not only do Europeans share a common worldview that their language, but their languages are very closely related. Therefore, what we take as a measure of foreignness is somewhat of an illusion, for the European languages, Germanic and Italic, are very close, being part of a larger family called Indo-European, which includes the Celtic, Slavic, Albanian, Greek, and Iranian languages, as well as a vast family of Indo-Aryan, sacred Sanskrit language. Finnish and Hungarian are not members of that just family. So anyway, maybe we can take a break right here so I don't wear myself out going deaf listening to my voice. So if you got some music there, Gunnarji, so you can sweeten the air a little bit.
Grandmother would tell us stories, stories of days of old. She would walk the whole earth in the snow and in the cold. She was comforted by the stories, comforted by the songs. She would sing them all day and all life long. She would sing, still in my heart. I will walk the whole earth with everything she's taught. I am comforted by her stories. I am comforted by her songs. I will sing them all day and all life long. I will sing.
Back?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll go on a little bit more here with these about languages, because this is something that's really terribly, terribly misunderstood. We think that, you know, it's a very simple thing. It's just noises and rules. For example, historically, the Western scientific vision, why jump ahead here? Anyway, the Uralic languages like Finnish and Hungarian have nothing really in common with your Indo-European. Thus, when we hear a language that's totally foreign to us, we may nevertheless be within our own language family, dealing with people who share our own values, culture, worldview, and science. That's very similar to the Athapascan family of languages that's spoken all the way from the subarctic in Alaska all the way down to northern Mexico. Many of them sound different, but yet they still express the same worldviews. So anyway, it says all these languages, which we're talking about, the ones from Europe or the Old World, have their origins in a single Proto-Indo-European that was spoken before 3000 BC. This may have been the language spoken by the nomadic Kurgan peoples who moved from southern Russia to the Danube area of Europe around 3500 BC. Indeed, Proto-Indo-European may have originated several thousand years before in an even earlier language that had something in common with the Uralic languages like Finnish and Hungarian. Thus, when we hear a language that's totally foreign to us, we may nevertheless be within our own language family. Native American languages, however, are profoundly different from Indo-European, and within the North American continent, there are several language families as different from each other as English is from Chinese. I think it's a very critical point to remember that we keep trying to be put in one box of natives, first native, first nations, whatever. But linguistically, our languages can be as different from each other as English is from Chinese. And then to read on, historically, the Western scientific vision has come to dominate large regions of the earth through its economic and technological power. All over the world, people watch movies and television programs, read textbooks, and operate computer programs, many of which were originally developed in English. Much scientific research is written and published in English. Even the study of linguistics is dominated by academics, books, and research articles that use English or one of the other European languages. Hence, even language itself is viewed through the perspective of European languages and worldview. Our technological world is so remarkably uniform that we take to be differences of attitude and culture are generally nothing more than variations upon one particular theme. When we enter the world of indigenous American languages, however, we encounter profoundly different concepts and worldviews. Indeed, not only are the concepts enfolded within the languages radically different, but even the meaning of the language itself and the function of sounds people make is profoundly different. Language, so traditional indigenous people say, is a door into their world. When I speak with Leroy Little Bear or Sake Henderson, I sense their struggle to find the right words in English for the sound vibrations within their own languages, for these sounds relate to a very different system of thought. As Sakij says, some mornings I wake up with my head full of rhythms and rhythms of rhythms and rhythms of rhythms of rhythms. And to speak English is like having to put on a straitjacket. When I get into a deep question with Leroy, he will remark, "Well, in Blackfoot we say," and produce a pattern of sound for me. Or he may pause and sing to himself very softly, as he tries to discover a way of putting the vibrations and all they convey into the particular linguistic structure demanded by English. The Algonquin peoples are concerned with the animation of all things within their process vision of the cosmos. Verbs are therefore the dominant feature of their language, some of them having well over 1,000 different endings. For the Iroquois peoples, Relationships are important, and as they are for all Indigenous peoples, and thus well over 100 different kinship terms are used in the Mohawk language. Learning Mohawk is not simply a matter of picking up vocabulary of unfamiliar words with the rules of grammar and syntax. It means being able to understand the meaning and nature of different relationships, realizing why they are important, and understanding the whole worldview in which they are embedded. The way a language differentiates between various relationships reflects the way a society chooses to structure itself. In societies like the Iroquois, many important decisions are made by women. In other societies, men play an important role. In some groups, the responsibility of a boy's growth to manhood belongs to his mother's brother. The blanket term uncle would clearly be inadequate in such a case, for it does not distinguish this privileged role from the less important role of the father's brother. This is a rather obvious case in which it is important for the language to make a distinction between the different forms of what Westerners see as one relationship. Other cases are far more subtle and can be understood only by a person who grows up and lives within a particular society. So anyway, next week we'll get a little bit more into these particular writings. And something else I'd like to be able to do is maybe each week we can have a word or a phrase of the week. And as we get guests in, they can give us a word and or a phrase that we can not only learn how the words are pronounced correctly, but also discuss the world view that's articulated in that word or phrase. It's like I use the word tawi, which is singular for taolong. Taolong has been translated to mean cousin. So this is not my brother or my sister or my uncle, which is my mother's brother, or my aunt, which is my father's sister. So again, you have to learn these relationships before you apply whatever term you're going to use to the relationship. So normally, tawi or taolong refers to the family of my father. My father's from the Raven side. He's a two-fin killer whale from the Brown Bear House and Shark House. So the people of that side of the family I would call the taolong. And that means that we're so closely related we can joke with each other real hard and we can't get mad. So just to say it's my cousin, that doesn't really tell me anything about the relationship or what my responsibilities are in that relationship. We have a phrase that translates that I'll use later at some later date. That's been translated to be social control through obligation and negotiation. And what that refers to is all these different possible relationships. When everybody lives in one open space, a longhouse, a teepee, a yurt, whatever, igloo, whatever, there's no privacy. Everybody is using the same space, sleeping, living, breathing, whatever. So there's always a possibility of conflict, or as we say, brushing against someone. So there had to be rules, and how do you behave in such a way that you avoid those conflicts, or if there is one, how do you resolve it without more conflict? So I know in that system that I defer to the older ones, but not always. I may defer to a younger man if the younger man is my sister's husband, because now the status would attach to her. So we have to know all these different relationships to be able to work out who's supposed to behave in certain ways. My uncle, my mother's brothers. It's not only my biological mother, but the women of my mother's generation of her two-headed eagle crest. priests at Janas. So all those men are my uncles. But I would assume that probably the biological brother of my biological mother would probably be the one that have the first pick to choose a nephew. And so we all had to listen to our uncles. We did what we were told. And if we did something that was not right, we might be told, that's enough. Uslavan, you're going to shame your uncle, or you're going to shame your grandfather, or if you're talking about somebody, you're going to make yourself ugly. So there's all these different ways in which social control was affected. I think in what I've heard from the other languages that these relationships are different with the different language groups, but essentially there is some commonality. Something that we found is that the certain values are expressed differently, but essentially they're the same. But when we take our world, which we'll say is pre-cash economy societies, versus the cash economy societies, there is a vast schism between the two systems. So the values expressed, this past weekend has been part of the Vancouver Society of Storytelling's 20th annual storytelling festival. And I've had the privilege of serving as its president for, 4 or 5 years. I'm no longer president. But anyway, storytellers come from all different language groups. I don't want to use the word race anymore. I think we need to get rid of that, because race implies that there's a contest as to who's going to get somewhere first, who's going to be number one. And that's not what life is really all about anyway. It is if you're in a cash economy. Then it's looking out for number one. Everything relates to money. Money is power. Money is personal power. It says knowledge is power. Everything is either power or money. And even intimate relationships, we'll say sexual relationships, in the cash economy, it's all about control and power. Whereas when you get to the pre-cash economy societies, it's a little different. In the cash economy society, where I went and got me a degree in economics, I learned about money. I learned about the lack of... I'm not supposed to trust anybody. Nobody ever really told me that specifically. But it said, well, you really can't trust anybody, because everybody's racing to get the best deal they can. It's looking out for number one. I no longer live in one room with everybody. I have to have my own personal space.
doing it themselves.
Wow.
You know, we have some young girls who are planning the opening, and it's just so amazing to see, you know, what they have. They're taking on these leadership roles all on their own. I just, you know, we just give them the tools, and they take it away.
Holy cow, amazing.
So you have the exhibit at the Museum of Anthropology, and then all these other activities are going to be at Musqueam?
Yes, Musqueam Claiming Spaces will be at the Musqueam Cultural Center Gallery from June 21st until the beginning of January. And right now, the Museum of Anthropology is running Claiming Spaces. That just opened, I believe, on the 1st of June, and it runs for 6 months as well.
Excellent. Can you tell us quickly about the graffiti artists, what that has entailed? I know that graffiti art is like a contemporary form of art, but what did the youth bring to graffiti? How did they fuse that?
We have one graffiti artist in our group, and his name's Chris Fasella, and he sprayed some canvases for us, and he wrote Huamusqueam in our Hunkaminam dialect, and it's just so cool. It's like he's like the first person in our history that I can think of that has taken it to that next level, you know, of writing our language in, you know, this new form of like art, graffiti art. So it's
what a way to bring it back.
Well,
yeah, for sure.
I want to ask you to do something for us. Is remember this phone number, write it down and pass it on to your friends and tell them, you know, we want to get, well, next week I'd like to be able to get a hold of a Musqueam speaker to come, probably maybe Larry Grant, to come in and we talk about the language, the worldview expressed by the language. And then if you have questions to ask, we'd like to leave time at the end of each program to where you can call and ask questions, or if you have something you want to say about the language. We might even have, I've heard, we could take, say, the word of the week. You know, I'll give you a word, and then next week you call in and say what it means to you, this sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That would be definitely something that we could totally do. And I'd just like to mention, too, there's two young girls that we've been working with, Kelsey Sparrow and Brittany Point. They actually speak our language, and Brittany's going to be presenting a speech in our language at the opening.
Beautiful.
And it's so cool to have these young women being able to know our language and speak our language. So I'd definitely love to bring them on the show, too, so they could their voice could be heard as well.
Okay, we're running out of time here. Christy Lee, thank you for calling us in. Give our listeners the place, time, and date one more time, and I'm going to play your song, Experimental, Experience.
Oh, Experience, yeah, for sure. I have to send you some more music, too.
Yes, for sure.
Okay, Musqueam Claiming Spaces opens June 21st. Our ceremony started at 11 o'clock. We're there all day. And come down, www.musqueam.bc.ca. Check our website for event details. So, yeah, everybody's welcome. Meets up Coquitlam. Come on down, guys. And thank you, Woody and Ganarji.
Thank you.
Sunlight, as long as you get high, right? shit. We went from genocide to democide, from culture shock to being opinionized, from savage to